Let us fight it out, Drawn.
He that fleeth, God give him his chance.
Now I have the mastery here. Off I smite this sorry squire. This knight's clothes will I wear, and in my hood his head will bear.
And that was the sound of Robin Hood summarily executing a vanquished foe in Robin Hood and the Knight. Hello, and welcome to the Beyond podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, General Overseer of Beyond, which specialises in creating full-cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, as well as providing background and other production resources. You can support our work and get a say in what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Anyway, today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Liz Oakley-Brown to discuss Robin Hood in drama. And I have to start with a massive apology, in fact, with four massive apologies. This is the first of four Lost Discussing episodes, recordings made in some cases many, many years ago, and never released for a number of reasons, not just the pandemic, but other technical reasons delayed them all. This was recorded in 2019, so yes, it was a few years. And it isn't the oldest recording yet to be released by a long chalk, so again, sorry. Anyway, before we go to my guest, a little background. Robin Hood appears in a fair number of surviving plays. The earliest we have done full audio versions of at the time of recording are Robin Hood and the Sheriff/Knight, which you've just heard, from the late 15th century, as well as Robin Hood and the Friar and Robin Hood and the Potter from somewhere in the middle of the 16th. And then there is a selection of large playhouse dramas from the end of the 16th into the 17th centuries. He kind of features in Edward I. He definitely features prominently in The Downfall of Robert, Earl of Huntingdon, by Anthony Munday, plus possibly others, as well as The Death of Robert, Earl of Huntingdon, which you could perhaps think of those two plays as Robin Hood's Parts 1 and 2. Robin is mostly in The Downfall, and that follows mostly the trajectory of Robin Hood's plays, films, etc., as you would know them. The Death of Robert, Earl of Huntingdon is only really opens with Robin and then shifts over to Marian, as it were, and I say mostly by Anthony Munday, as well as other plays, including Robin, in a slightly different way. He's there as a young man in Look About You, one we enjoy very much, and also as an older man looking over his shoulder in George a Green, another one we can recommend highly. Finally, there's the incomplete play The Sad Shepherd by Ben Jonson. This discussion will dance around all of these plays and includes cutaways to some of the recordings we've since made on these texts, even though we frequently refer to the then-recent script-in-hand readings by Red Not Dead at the Globe. These recordings you will hear are from our first-look readings of all these plays, as well as a fun second look at George a Green, and of course the full-cast audio stuff that we have already done. All links to all of those things are in the show description. So, let's say hello to our guest and talk about outlaws. So, my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
I'm Dr. Liz Oakley-Brown and I'm Senior Lecturer here in the English Literature Department at Lancaster University. My interest in outlawry started when I was an undergraduate at Cardiff University, and I had the great pleasure of working with Stephen Knight. And that really gave me an insight into the possibilities of thinking about outlawry in terms of the cultural purchase of the figure, but also the popularity of that figure. And Robin Hood, of course, is one of those folkloric figures that has a vast appeal in Western culture. And so when I became a lecturer here at Lancaster, quite a long time ago now, I'd already published on the Anthony Mundy play. That came via an opportunity from Stephen Knight way back as a postgraduate, when I was a postgraduate. So I thought it would be interesting to combine my love of Robin Hood and outlawry with piracy, mm-hmm. as you do. And so in 10 weeks, I run a course called Early Modern Outlaws on Land and Sea, where we look at Robin Hood and also the figure of the pirate, predominantly on the early modern stage.
Well, I'm quite happy to segue into piracy. Nothing like a bit of piracy.
So I suppose most recently then, it was really interesting to me thinking about the ways, if we focus on Robin Hood, how it's almost a cliche to think that interest in that figure erupts at moments of English crisis, if you like. And I say this without comment, but how interesting then that the Globe decided in 2019 to put on a series of Robin Hood plays as part of their Red Not Dead series. And then I also had the brilliant opportunity of going beyond my interest in the Anthony Mundy and Henry Chettle plays, The Downfall and the Death of Robin Hood, to look at the other plays that hardly ever get mentioned.
Who is Robin Hood? Throughout the course of his life, during the period we're talking about, what's going on?
Well, I'm going to cite the brilliant Lois Potter, of course, who's actually working with the Globe on the series of plays. So she's kind of their academic consultant for all of the plays that are being performed.
Future Robert popping in again. I should mention that Lois Potter is now a regular on our YouTube exploring sessions and will appear in a future discussing episode very soon. But anyway, back to the discussion as Dr. Liz Oakley-Brown references Lois's work.
Playing Robin Hood, the legend as performance in five centuries, begins by saying that Robin Hood is... The essays in this collection work on the assumption that Robin Hood is a role rather than a historical character. So that gets us straight into the idea of this shape-shifting figure, if you like, that, yes, does crop up in the chronicles, and that's a whole other load of scholarship. But if you're interested in who is Robin Hood, the historical figure, you can do that. But I'm of the Lois Potter, Stephen Knight school of interest. Let's see what the kind of creative response is, if you like, to this figure have been. And so I think it's almost a cliche or a truism in Robin Hood studies now to say that the first literary reference to the figure is in Piers Plowman, which kind of makes the link there through the satirical figure of Sloth, I think, about Robin Hood's narratives being allied with sort of idleness and not being very serious. But actually, if you then turn to those plays that were performed from the sort of late 16th century on the stage, what happens is that they deal with all kinds of social violence, actually. I mean, if I just go back a little bit to the medieval ballads, the Robin Hood that we see there in those fragments is not the kind of benign character who takes from the rich and gives to the poor. He sort of takes from figures of authority and keeps it. And often does dreadful, and I'm trying to smile when I say this, but dreadful acts of violence, as you probably know.
Well, yes. I mean, the text we worked on, you know, the Robin Hood and the Potter I find fascinating because it's basically a protection racket. He's literally going, oh, you have some pots here.
Let me see. Are the pots whole and sound?
Yeah, master, but they will not break the ground.
I will them break. For the cuckold, thy master's sake. And if they will break the ground, thou shalt have 3 pence for a pound. Ha! Oops!
Mash! No! Stop it! Outer lass, what have you done? Oops!
Yeah. And smash and...
Yeah.
And obviously there's a fun element there in terms of tone, because it's about collecting money and there's the community about... So it's working in a different way to a playhouse drama.
Yeah.
So the tone is obviously not as dark and evil as that suggests. But yes, there's a very different figure coming across.
Exactly. And I don't know if you know Robin Hood and the Monk.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, where we get decapitation of not only the monk, but his small boy helper. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Guy of Gisborne, Robin Hood and Guy of Gisborne, which is incredibly violent. And I think that most people are not aware of that ballad tradition. But I think it's that tradition that one needs to be aware of to get a sense of then what subsequent genres and cultures do with that figure, really. Mm. And what you get, I suppose, and this again comes out of Lois Potter's work on the figure, is, you know, in those early ballads, you see this trickster figure, don't you? This figure who is very capable of disguise and taking on different demeanours, quite often for, you know, as you say, issues of extortion and extreme violence. Mm. But I think that's why Lois Potter can say, you know, that he's a figure to do as a role playing, as a role, because I think that this is what Robin Hood, you know, scare quotes, then comes to stand for, really. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very difficult, although people try and I try and other people try to sort of do these kind of, you know, generic stabilising things. But then when you see the plays again that the Globe are putting on, just how different the treatment is, and actually the plays that I've spoken on, you know, in the kind of setting the scene discussions. Mm. I think it's no coincidence that Lois has done the Monday plays, the ones that I was hoping to get, because I'm familiar with them. So I got Georgia Green and Look About You. But I'm very pleased I did, actually, because Look About You, I mean, how do you know what that's about? You're asking who's Robin Hood, but that play is like, what's the play about?
Yeah.
You know, doesn't it, a teenage Robin Hood, the prequel, if you like, to the Monday plays. Mm. And perhaps for me thus far is the most kind of extreme reiteration or refashioning of that figure that I've encountered thus far. And the performance, though, it's a rip-roaring 3.5 hours, actually. Mm. The pace of it is extraordinarily well-pitched, well-paced. It works really well in performance.
Battle with the stars to pull him down from heaven if he were there.
Look to Earl John. The gentleman is mad.
Oh, who would not be mad at this disgrace? Gloucester, the fox, is fled. There lies his case.
He says, pointing to his gown.
He cozened me of mine. The porter helped him.
Porter shall be hanged. Let's part and seek him. Gloucester shall die. All Europe shall not save him.
He is wise, too wise for us. Yet I'll go with you to get more fools into my company.
Again, it takes that idea. So this is why I'm very much taken with Lois Potter's take on the role playing. Mm. Because it takes that aspect, doesn't it, of that aspect that surrounds Robin Hood narrative, it's around that figure, and sort of just pushes it to the absolute limit, I think.
Well, it is that thing of, as you were saying, it's a role that you can inhabit and move and shift the boundaries on. And obviously we've got these six extant plays that we can actually compare and contrast and say, over a relatively short period of time, a lot of different interpretations appear. What would you say are the big differences between the plays?
I would say that if you start with Edward I, which is a play I'm the least familiar with, actually, so I'm not going to say too much about it, except that what, you know, is that the figures in that play actually use a kind of a bookish, they enact an enactment of Robin Hood. It's very self-reflexive, isn't it? It's a play about a Robin Hood play. So I think it perhaps begins to show how Robin Hood moves from popular culture, folkloric materials to the professional stage in really interesting ways.
Nell, adieu, we go for news. A little serves the friar's lust when Nolens Volens, fast I must, master at all that you refuse.
Such a potter would I choose, when I mean to blind excuse. While Robin walk with little John, the fire will take his Marion, so will the potter if he can.
So that would be where I'd go with that. Mm. I suppose. And then you follow on, I guess, with Georgia Green.
Yeah, I was going to say, approximate chronology.
Somebody asked me on Twitter what the chronology was. And do you know, I just think of them as clusters. Georgia Green, which again is something I actually wasn't familiar with very well. So I thought, yes, why not go and talk about it? Because it gives you an opportunity to grasp it. Mm. And again, I was interested in that play about how it depends on the audience being very familiar with a kind of backstory of Robin Hood. In order for the humour to work, you know, you've got a really sort of grumpy Maid Marian who's sort of very fed up with the fact that Georgia Green and Beatrice, you know, are more well known than her and Robin Hood. But also, I think more seriously, perhaps what's interesting is how London centric that play is, and how everybody up north, you know, isn't it interesting? Perhaps I'm kind of more aware of that because I am up north, although I'm a southerner. How the Yorkshire element, you know, the Pinner of Wakefield is treated really with this by this London centric play.
What have you any more? Call all your town forth, Cuts and Longtail.
What, Georgia Green? Is it you? A plague found you. I think you long to swinge me well. Come, George, we will crush a pot before we part.
A pot, you slave? We will have 100. Oh, here, Will Perkins, take my purse. Fetch me a stand of ale and set in the marketplace that all may drink that are athirst this day. For this is for a fee, to welcome Robin Hood to Bradford Town.
So I think, again, that's that regionality. You know, and you've got, it's set in this very ill-defined historical period. I think what's interesting that Edward I clearly has got a particular historical period in mind. Georgia Green is kind of very vague, you know, sort of James who, John Richard who, not too specific.
Yeah.
And then Look About You again, sort of, if we take that one, sort of goes back to kind of a more, the period of history, you know, where we've got two Henrys for the first time or for the first time ever, you know, two kings on the throne, and it kind of works out from that idea.
Yeah.
This idea of doubling, and I think it takes that idea of doubling historically. Yeah.
Just a sort of a sideways thought, because in a sense, these are, you could define them as history plays.
And
that sense of, what are they saying about this semi-mythic past? I mean, in that sense, you know, what are they saying England was or could be, or is there a connection between the politics of the time, or am I just sort of saying a long string of words, which is what I'm just doing?
I have to speak then. This is when I put my theoretical cards on the table, which I always like to do. You know, I'm a cultural materialist, so I will always look at issues of sort of power and economy, and the differences, I suppose, between those who have and have not, which you can see the appeal there of the Robin Hood narratives for critics like me, actually. And I would say that in the plays we're talking about is that they're about legitimacy, you know, who gets to actually say what is lawful and what isn't. And particularly, I think, in Look About You, where you've got this issue of two kings, which is based in history and so on. So who then is, who's the sovereign, you know, who's got ultimate power? And for me, actually, Look About You, more than any of the Robin Hood plays or texts that I've actually encountered thus far, has become very, very clear example of a text that wants to explore rightful legal power and the place of the common person in that. And I think Robin Hood then becomes more complex. Robin Hood, particularly in that play, is very much part of the elite. But then, of course, Robin Hood, in a way, except perhaps in the early ballads, in the jest tradition, he's always got this very, I think, interesting relationship with kingship.
So my mind's going sideways again, because we're working on the life and death of Jack Straw at the moment. Questions of power and relationship, and because you've got a very young king and you've got the various forces enacting around him within the court, as well as the actual rebellion and the evolution of the rebellion throughout the plan. Is just, yes, they are also outlaws. This is a legitimate thing I should be thinking about.
But then I think, again, I mean, you could bring every play down to that in a way, or every text down to that, and it can be quite a reduction. But I think what's interesting about then thinking about these plays that use Robin Hood, and they are using Robin Hood in some ways. I mean, Edward I is using it a very different way to Georgia Green, very different again to Look About You. And then we're going to see, you know, this, people have argued, Stephen Knight particularly, and others after him, that the Monday plays are the first time, the inauguration, the gentrification of the figure. Mm. Again, it depends on where you situate those plays, I suppose, but you can see then how the kind of post-Enlightenment reiterations of Robin Hood have taken that very much on board. I'm thinking there about the 1938 film, you know, and so on.
Knocking the edges off the beheading, you know, possibilities of him.
I think all that Robin does in the Earl of Huntingdon plays is sort of whip a kind of a napkin around at the beginning, as far as I can remember, and sort of be a bit stroppy and petulant if you performed him in that way, and then go off to the woods and become all kind of, you know, elite there. Then, of course, we've got Ben Jonson, who we've not mentioned thus far, have we?
No.
Ben Jonson, something else again.
As a fragmentary text, which I'm very interested in fragmentary text, because there's so much more room for manoeuvre, in a sense. Yeah. Yes, tell me a bit about The Sad Shepherd.
Well, The Sad Shepherd, you know, the title pretty much gives it all away. The subtitle is A Tale of Robin Hood.
Mm. Hath any vermin broke into your fold? Or any rot seized your flock? Or cold? Or hath your fighting ram burst his hard horn? Or any ewe her fleece? Or bag hath torn, my gentle Amy?
Harriet, none of these.
Have you been stung by wasps, or angry bees, or raised with some rude bramble, or rough briar?
No, Marian, my disease is somewhat nigher. I weep and boil away myself in tears, and then my panting heart would dry those fears. I burn, and through all the forest lend a shade and freeze, though of the whole wood one fire were made.
Alas!
What you've got there, if we talk about outlawry and law, so we've got this very gentry, we've got this sad shepherd, but park them at the moment. But we're all in a wood, aren't we? So we're all in this kind of courtly wood.
Yes.
So again, I suppose it's that idea of gentrification being pushed then into this other kind of area. But it brings Robin Hood then, this sort of outlaw figure from history, together then with the figure of the witch. Mm. Another figure who is, you know, well, I think, you know, as the feminist to me wants to say, kind of even more a persecuted figure, and in terms of 17th century history. So again, in some respects, or at least in my way, you can see how I might teach this play. It's kind of how we've got then this sort of archetypal, almost, well, this canonical, I think, outlaw by this time, who's now been so wonderfully gentrified. He's hardly the focus at all because he's so uninteresting. I mean, Marion's quite interesting, actually, in this scenario. I think that setting allows Marion to be slightly more proactive.
Well, the appearance of Marion as a figure anyway, I mean, the early pieces don't feature her at all. In fact, if they do feature a woman, they are not necessarily a figure that one is supposed to idolise. So the evolution of her as a figure, is there a narrative to that? Do we?
You can, again, people like Lois Potter and theatre historians have done a very good job. It comes out of, I think, the kind of the May Day games. And when you have a young boy, you know, playing the part of the May Queen, if you like. So she gets introduced, that figure gets introduced along in that part of the tradition, if you like, so those sort of May Day celebrations. She joins, I suppose, the cast of on stage Marians, if you have performance Marians, perhaps, it depends on the order that we put these plays in, but with the Monday plays. Again, and what's so interesting then about that those two plays, the Down from the Death, is that you've got the corruption of the name, at least in the editions that we have, don't we? But Marian Matilda, who knows what she's called? Is she based on, you know, who knows what the actual origin story is of that? That's why I think in terms of Ben Jonson's piece, that Marian, I think, is actually far more, you know, gets a far better deal, if you like, in terms of narrative, in terms of outlaw narratives. I think she, you know, there's a point where she's sort of dressed in buskins and sort of is allowed to actually maybe go out and hunt, you know?
Yeah.
Perhaps courtly fashion, but she takes on a more proactive outlawry role. And that's why, you know, students particularly quite like this play, because actually they forget about, in fact, the Sad Shepherd is a bit, you know, they're not that interested in the Sad Shepherd, nor are they interested in Robin Hood. So, of course, they're interested in the witch and Marian. And perhaps it's that kind of Jacobean court mask type thing. Of course, nobody really knows what this was produced for, but in terms of production, do they? But it might have been that whole issue that maybe this has had a more of a sort of woman-centric set of performers in mind, audience in mind, group in mind. This goes back to this idea, doesn't it, of Robin. You know, who is Robin? What is Robin? I think these figures allow this figure and the cast of characters that surround this figure to sort of put into different scenarios in wonderful ways.
Yes. You have this ensemble that evolves and they all serve different functions, or potentially serve different functions, and so the playwright can focus on a different person if they want to do something different.
Yeah.
And that's quite useful, whereas other more singularly focused figures maybe less so.
Yeah, and I think as well, I mean, it struck me then sort of preparing the Georgia Green piece and then watching it, you know, in the stage reading, what a fabulous sort of playing performance that is as well. Mm. You know, and again, far more weapon-led. I would say comparing what I noticed about that, what you notice in these plays, I think are props actually. Mm. As you can imagine, look about you. You really need that clothing to sort of make sense of the whole thing, you know. I think perhaps these are pieces that appeal to acting companies and they bring the audience with them, if that makes sense. Mm. I think even if you'd had a period of rehearsal with Look About You, you're going to have to be, it's a huge company, you'd have to be very tight-knit to actually pull that off.
Yeah.
You know, it's an incredible amount of choreography as well.
Yeah, it's a busy work.
So that's a good way of putting it in terms of, you know, speech, from speech patterns to, as I say, props and everything in between.
Yeah.
Georgia Green, similarly, you know, I'm always going there thinking there's going to be lots of bows and arrows. So if I'm looking out for props, maybe that's what I'm always looking out for. So sadly, none in Look About You. There's one, I don't know if you're in Georgia Green, but a kind of a child uses it. And it's all about staffs.
Yes.
Great big whacking things. Well, the violence, again, is kind of handled differently.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the earliest sort of performance text of the Robin Hood and the Knight and the Sheriff, depending on what you want to call which is a pitched battle.
Exactly.
The script is really just a cue in for the set piece that happens. And you know, maybe there was more, but it's more it's a much more external event. And again, the other two pieces are all about at some point someone's going to have a fight. Someone is going to challenge someone to a fight. Let's watch the fight.
Yeah.
Some plays obviously exploit fights, and some companies were much more fight orientated than others. Sure. So I suppose there's a question of context of when the playwright or who the playwright was writing for.
Yeah.
I, as a producer, I'm always looking at props as well, because it's a case of, you know, when a script says large brazen head, I'm going, maybe won't do Friar Bacon. Maybe won't do that one. Because the moment you need to start manufacturing things, then
And I think actually what maybe actually, because I'm not, you know, I don't work in sort of practice sort of based research really, but I'm very interested in it. I know people that do, but what struck me about the two stage readings I've seen, that they work really well, and I don't even think a more expensive production would achieve more. You know, the energy I think is what you need. They are both fast. And the use of props are quite minimal, but important.
Yeah.
You know, and you can do a lot with different hats for Look About You, for example, but key. Yeah. But you just need to be agile and really good at your craft, I think, to actually perform them effectively.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, one of the interesting things, because we start off with audio before we move into doing plays, it makes you think about the physical world more.
No, I can get that.
And so I'm increasing, you know, any bit of comic business. You know, we try and break down as or physical comedy business, if that makes sense, or any physical business. Yeah, you know, we break down to quite ridiculous degrees because we have to figure out, well, what of this can we get across? But that's useful for us ahead, in the sense of, you know, if we can, you know, move into larger scale productions.
So I think it is about, but I also think about speech patterns as well, which is why I'd be interested to hear what you do, particularly with this tranche of plays. Because, as I say, they seem to me to really, really focus on the craft of the late 16th century professional theatre in ways. You know, the more I see and the more I think about it and the more I have conversations with people like you that are kind of expert in this area, the more it gives me another way into thinking about the texts in terms of, you know, their different sort of appearance, their spikes, you know, in kind of history, if you like. And who's kind of driving them to be performed. And I reckon, yes, they are popular figures, but I'm guessing, this is speculation, obviously, like a lot of this is, but for companies, they can take a figure that they can reckon that most people have heard of somehow and do things with it.
There's a reason why even today, revivals of any format in films, you know, people keep remaking things and doing things with the same materials, including Robin Hood. A, people think it's something we can sell. People like to buy what they already know.
Exactly.
Again, that's sort of the why we start with a podcast. There's no point putting on a show we can't sell. So we pre-sell a show by telling everyone about the material as much as possible in advance. But the other thing, when you're talking about clusters, it just that is important because, of course, we sometimes get too focused on when it was written.
Oh, gosh,
the question is, how long was it in a repertoire?
Yeah.
Because then the idea of a cluster is important because it may be part of a cluster of 20 plays that, you know, lasted together for a quite a long time. So if they were popular, thinking of, you know, George Green and Edward I as sort of connected,
even if
they weren't in the same company. I mean, because companies would be in competition.
Yeah.
Out of the plays that you've worked on, are there any moments or scenes that are your particular favourites?
I think actually...
I should have prepped you on that one.
I just thought of it. I think the unexpected... I want to say performability, that's not a word. How well they work in performance.
Yeah.
How much more entertain... How really properly entertaining they are. And that's not because, you know, I'm a particular fan. I'm interested, of course. And I kind of like to explore areas that I'm not familiar with, really. But I have to say that having seen Look About You and Georgia Green, you know, in the stage reading, just delighted with just how well they work as ensemble pieces and how well they work. You can't. What I'm struggling to do is to isolate moments because they really, for me, are proper ensemble pieces. They're kind of they're all important. You can't extract.
They're context driven.
Because they're kind of integral. They work. They're all. If you try to extract anything from Look About You, it'd make even less sense than it does. You need the whole thing. You can't appreciate it until you kind of get to the end.
Yeah.
When Eleanor says, you know, wondrous conversion, you go, too right, Eleanor. That's what I mean about being self-reflexive and having fun about it. How are we going to end this then?
Yeah.
I'm going to use this sort of vaguely historical detail with, you know, young Henry's conversion, possibly, to kind of bring it all together. Maybe that moment. Maybe it's how they end. Bring all these kind of, how they're going to end this particular, because this is a narrative which never ends, obviously.
Yeah.
And each play has to at some point. So it's that artificiality, the beginning. So perhaps the beginning's interesting, but actually where it's going to end. So I think every performance and every text has its own kind of texture and is animated by the people that kind of work with them. And so I'm just interested to see what you do. I just love working with or alongside or watching people sort of animate these particular texts because it's not what I do, but I love like thinking about them. They help me think through them. I think just to end on Look About You, which is a pretty good place to end, that, you know, King John is in this kind of tragic mode and talking about revenge, you know, and young Robin's doing something else completely. And then you've got, you know, the kind of, let's call them the comic figures, you know, sort of like Skink and Redcap and Block. You know, doing other things, and it's just, you know, that's what I mean about being a performer's play, really. Because I think as a member of the audience, I think, you know, you're completely wrong-footed or whatever body part you want to wrong, you know, this, but it's kind of, you're not really quite sure. I suppose with Robin coming on, you go, oh, maybe it's Robin. Oh, no, it isn't. So, it's for me, I think that's been the most illuminating play I've come across for a very long time, because, of course, its title, which is, you know, those kind of interrogative titles.
Oh, and there is that clue too, you know, to the play. It's because it's doing in so many different directions.
Yeah.
You know, it has a very...
Exactly.
We were talking about The Sad Shepherd, you know, what's it about? you know, they did know their business. Title sometimes.
Exactly, and I think that again, it's sort of with those sort of very ambiguous plays. You think that in terms of marketing them, you know, they had particularly that play is sort of bouncing off of the popularity of all kinds of things.
And that was our discussion on Robin Hood. Many thanks to Dr. Liz Oakley-Brown for giving their time to discuss the plays and for being so patient with the release of this recording. And you'll be able to hear more on Look About You in an upcoming episode soon. In the clips of full cast audio and readings were, in no particular order, Geir Madland, Lois Potter, Alan Scott, Bryony Sparrow, Helen Good, Alexandra Kattegida, and Lynn Freitas. And all of the Robin Hood material can be found via links in the show description. You've been listening to the Beyond podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Beyond Shakes, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/Beyond Shakespeare, or buy us a coffee on ko-fi.com/Beyond Shakespeare, and all that jazz. Till next time, I've been your host, Robert Crichton. Goodbye.